Hello, friends. We are back with another amazing episode of Being Unemployable. But guess what? This week is going to be even more fun because we are interviewing the amazing, the fantastic April. And how do I pronounce your last name? Because I'm not sure if I've ever been pronouncing it correctly.
It's Mastroluca.
Okay, that. So I'm not sure if I can say that again. And Maggie is here as well. She'll be chiming in. But we're talking about a really cool topic today, which is this, and tell me if I'm saying this right, April, but this mask of feeling like you have to have all of your shit together all of the time. When you're asked questions, you have to be the knower of all things, pretty much Google personified, and letting down the guard of, oh, I don't actually know all the things, or maybe needing help seems really, really scary. Am I saying that correctly?
Absolutely. It's the whole issue with masking and, you know, being comfortable with wearing those masks after wearing them for so long, and kind of recognizing them and wondering if you're willing to give them up.
Okay. So first of all, for those who maybe are new, masking is when you try to appear more like maybe a typical person versus a neurodiverse person. But this one's a little different because it's really masking, trying to look like you're the knower of all things versus just being a human. So April, talk to me about what masking looks like for you.
I think for me, I'm the person that people come to when they have questions. I mean, I'm generally the finder of all knowledge. You know, where can I find, you know, a contractor to redo my kitchen? Ask April. You know, where can I find how to build XYZ? Ask April. It's just because of the things that I've been able to do in my life, most of them have been me kind of saying I can do it and then figuring out how to do it really quickly so that people think that I know how to do it. So it's like, it's kind of like imposter syndrome on a mega, mega scale.
Okay. And I may or may not have ADHD, April. So let's wind it back a little bit and tell everyone what it is that you do, a little bit about you, because it turns out I forgot to do that when you first came on here. So we want to know all the things.
Well, and honestly, it's because you and I have talked before and we have had 2-hour Zoom conversations.
Oh, that's a short conversation. I don't know if we've ever had just a 2-hour conversation, but sorry, go ahead.
So I work in nonprofit consulting. I've been in nonprofit for over 20 years. And I also have a coaching arm of my business that is designed to help people who are at a crossroads in life and are trying to figure out which way to go. And it all comes back to me being a problem solver and a solution finder. So that's actually the title I gave myself for my consulting company. I'm chief solution finder, because I always thought problem solver was negative. So I have done everything from working in accounting to working in media, radio and television, to I served in the state legislature and have been an advocacy expert. And now I do nonprofits. So it's a wide range of things. And kind of part of that whole masking is that everyone assumes that I have a college degree and ask me where I went to college, and I have none. I tried college a couple times and now understand that that was just not a good path for me with my ADHD. So it's kind of that whole masking thing of people just assume that I'm really, really smart, which I am, which meant I went to college, which I didn't.
As long as you don't say you went to the School of Hard Knocks, I think we're all okay. Because that is my least favorite response when someone says, where'd you go to school? And they're like, Hard Knocks. Anyway, I'm popping in here because you literally gave yourself the position of the mask that you wear. Did you see that? by saying
I didn't, but thank you for pointing that out, because I did not see that.
As soon as you said, like, I provide solutions, it's like, that's what we're talking about today. So I'm going to go back off, because I just like listening to this conversation. But it's like when you're listening to a podcast and you just start talking to Spotify as if it's listening to you. That's what I'm doing over here on mute. So I have the ability to unmute and actually engage, unlike all of you listening at home.
Oh, well, see, I do the same thing when I listen to your podcast, but then I just text Jamie and like give her my answers as I'm listening to it. So.
And I love it and I appreciate it. Okay. So I love that Maggie pointed that out, because I was noticing that too. We're talking about how uncomfortable it is to not be the knower of all things, but positioning yourself as the knower of all things, you've accomplished these amazing things, but therefore you're still positioning yourself as the knower of all things. Mm-hmm. So I want to ask you, April, what your thoughts are. When does it become a no longer such a positive thing to break through the imposter syndrome by deeming yourself the solution finder? When does it become an issue?
It's weird. I don't think it's an issue for me. I think it's a matter of being diagnosed later in life and now recognizing about the masks. I was talking to a coach early on after I was diagnosed, and she had asked me the question about, well, what would it look like if you took off all the masks? And I didn't even hesitate. I said, it would be terrifying, because I don't know who that person is, because I have never seen her. Or if I have, it's been a really long time. And I don't even know if I like that person. So the masks are, you know, kind of the security blanket. And thinking through that, you know, since I've been diagnosed, like, that's the biggest one. You know, that's kind of my all-encompassing, looking like I'm normal, you know, looking like I'm neurotypical, and especially being in different, you know, in different jobs that people assume you can't do if you're not neurotypical. But when I look back, for example, in politics, a lot of the lobbyists, now that I think about it, I would venture to guess they're not neurotypicals. Mm-hmm. I think some of them may have autism, mm-hmm. But they're really, really good at their jobs because they're not emotional about it. They're able to look at things very black and white and just say, okay, I understand that, but how do we get to this solution? And so I think I take some of that, because I'm always the one that's like, I just go for the simplest thing. And people are like, no, that won't work. And they'll go through all these steps and they go, oh, well, let's do this. And I'm like, oh, you mean the thing that I mentioned like 3 days ago? Mm-hmm. So it's that kind of trying to fit in, but also wanting to be able to share my skill as a problem solver.
So this mask that you carry can look maybe different in different settings. And you touched on like how it looked like in politics. So I would love to talk a little bit about, maybe delve into that a little bit more, but I'd also want to know how this shows up in your personal life as well.
In social situations, if you say to me, oh, well, so you know about XYZ, and I don't, I'm like, oh yeah, uh-huh. And then I will play along until I figure it out. And the way I recognized that I was actually doing that is my best friend, who is probably the smartest person I've ever met, just so incredibly intelligent. And when we're having a conversation, she would constantly interrupt me to ask me a question about what I was talking about. Okay, but who is that? What does that mean? What does that acronym mean? And in the beginning, I would get really frustrated, like, why are you doing this? And then it was kind of, I realized, oh, I'm actually a little bit envious because I don't do that. I don't have the confidence to ask the question, because if I ask the question, then I don't know. And then I don't look as smart and as accomplished as I play that I am, or that I may be, because I asked a question. To me, asking a question is a weakness. So I've gotten better over the last few years of being aware of that and trying to ask questions, but it's still really, really difficult and really scary, because it's being vulnerable.
That is, oh, sorry.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. That's why she's the smartest person you know.
Yeah.
Because every time she doesn't Jamie does this. Every time she doesn't understand something, she asks immediately. And that's one of the best things that I noticed early on with Jamie is
thank you.
As soon as she doesn't understand, she's like, okay, now what am I doing here? What does this mean? Like, mm-hmm. And even when she Googles and gets an answer herself, she'll send it to me and say, I don't understand how this ties into what we're talking about. And she's genuinely like, I tried to find the answer. I didn't find the answer. What are we talking about? And that's like, I welcome that with open arms, because I'm like, that's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
To be so teachable that you're like, no, I don't know what we're discussing. I thought I knew, and now I don't. Explain it to me. And it's like, okay. Like, how cool. Meanwhile, if I don't know what we're talking about, I'm just like, hey, I gotta go. I'm like, I don't know. Like, I have a thing. And then I just leave.
Well, but the other end of that spectrum really is when somebody asks me a question and I'm just like in my head, like, have you heard of Google? And then I will go on Google and I will find the answer and I will send it to them. And like, here you go. Takes me like 2 minutes. And I discovered that a lot of people don't even know like the right words to put in Google to find the answers that they're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started my business, even though I had been in nonprofit for 20 years, I am a collector of information. And I have the biggest folder on my computer is called research, and it's broken into subfolders of every different area where I have found samples or examples or different ways of looking at things that I have. And so I have another consultant that I work with, and she'll send me research projects, and 90% of the stuff I can just pull right out of my computer because I save it. And the good news is I look at the majority of it, unlike, say, for example, my Pinterest board, which is full of things that 90% of them I've never gone back and looked at ever again. But I save them because they're really cool. And it's better than the whole like me tearing stuff out of magazines that I did when I was younger and had these piles of papers that I never looked at again.
A little bit more consolidated when it's on your Pinterest board instead of piles of paper. That makes sense. So you touched on like this comes. So first of all, you've been diagnosed with ADHD for how long now?
Actually, it'll be 2 years in June.
Okay, so not even 2 years. And you talked about how this mask came about due to not having that diagnosis. Is that correct? I don't want to be putting words in your mouth.
No, I think the mask came, I mean, I think that was part of it, but I think the mask came about from childhood trauma that I dealt with, that Maggie and I have talked about, with just issues with my mother, who I'm pretty sure was bipolar, looking back now as an adult, and having to basically raise myself. I mean, when my parents separated, my mom bailed just mentally. And so from the age of 12 on, I was in charge of the house, and I was the one that, you know, figured things out and how to pay the bills and how to keep, you know, keep things clean and, you know, continue to put on that persona that we, you know, that our families all did, that our lives were perfect, and not knowing the difference until I got older and was talking to someone that I knew that was actually going to school to become, a psychologist, and was just talking about my life and not knowing that the things that happened to me when I was younger was not normal. And But so I couldn't let that on. I couldn't let people know that outside of the house. So I had to put on this mask that everything was fine and I had everything under control and I could definitely handle it. So it's just, and I've, looking back, I've obviously been really convincing because I've had jobs that I was totally not qualified for, especially when I was younger, but I gave people the idea that I could do it and got the job and then figured out how to do it.
I am seeing the full picture now. So you not only in your household, you were put into this role of knower of all things, because if you weren't the knower and doer of all things, the house collapsed. But then you also had to take that persona into the outside world, almost as like a shell of protection for the person who's supposed to be protecting you and being the knower and doer of all things as well. I would imagine that, I can't imagine that was, must have been incredibly challenging as a child with, I mean, with as ADHDers, we don't have a fully developed frontal lobe anyway, but like a very underdeveloped frontal lobe, your brain is not developed. Emotional regulation is challenging as it is, and you are a literally a child in this position. I can't even imagine how challenging that was for you.
But again, as a person with ADHD, like we don't think about what's challenging. We just do what needs to be done and yeah. We don't know any different. And I remember when my kids were younger and people are like, oh my gosh, how do you do all this stuff? Oh, you're the most organized person I know. And I'm just like, oh, I have so got you snowed. Like I am not. And I didn't think anything of the stuff that I did. And after I left my job, I was going back through some emails looking for something. I went back a couple of years and I realized that at one point in my life, I was raising a teenager and a preteen, married. I had a job that required travel all around the country. I was going to school because I tried to go back to college and I was, you know, not taking like easy stuff. I decided to take theology because why not? And then was running for office and actively campaigning and doing volunteer work all at the same time. And I'm just like, how in the world did I do all that? But it was just, that's what needed to be done. And so I did it, you know, that's just kind of how it's always been. If I'm in a situation, I'm always the one that can hold my head together and kind of keep everybody together. And in a lot of difficult situations, I tend to be the person that makes sure everybody gets fed, and I am comic relief. I am the one that really helps people get through a situation by kind of trying to lighten the mood a little bit and help take their minds off things and making sure that they're okay.
And not only that, being the comic relief, solving the problems, as someone with ADHD, it feeds your dopamine.
Mm-hmm.
So you're getting praise for solving problems. You're getting praise for making people laugh. All of these things become part of the loop that keeps mm-hmm. you on the hamster wheel. So it's not surprising at all that this kept going. And you kept eating your own tail. Like, it's not surprising. And the whole thing stemmed, I agree, with your childhood trauma, because I have that as well. And I was an only child. So when my parents like mentally checked out on me, it was like, okay, if you want to take a lunch, you pack your own lunch. Mm-hmm. I mean, later though, I will say once my stepdad found out that I was taking a thing of Pop-Tarts for lunch, he started packing me a lunch because he was an educator. And the idea of someone seeing me with just Pop-Tarts for lunch, he was like, well, that's going to look bad for me. I'm like, oh yeah, sure. Well, cause you're a terrible human. So, the whole thing with the childhood trauma though, is something you and I talked about, which is, it's a sign of weakness to ask for help mm-hmm. in the way we were raised. And when I see Jamie, for example, and people who had parents who encourage curiosity. I'm like, oh shit, what must that be like?
Mm-hmm.
The other day, Sean said to me, yesterday, day before, he said, what was normal in your house, but like when you see someone else's house, it wasn't. And I was like, oh, child abuse. I was like, that was normal in my house, but not in everybody else's house. And he was like, that's not what I meant. I meant more like, like meal time, you know, like rituals, like stuff like that. And I was like, oh, well, for me, it was just child abuse. I don't know, whatever.
Yeah, but I didn't know that getting beaten with a shoe was not normal until I saw the horror on my friend's face when my mother did it.
Right? Like, I didn't know being pulled around by your hair when you stepped in when you stepped in the carpet shampoo wasn't a reasonable response until I was like, yeah, my mom did that. That's why I have that hair missing. And mm-hmm. people were like, oh, that's a shame. It is a shame. Like, could we do something about it?
Yeah.
No, we cannot. Well,
I can relate to the food, you know, the lunch thing, because I was the one that filled out the paperwork to get free lunch at school because we didn't have the money to pay for lunch and we had no groceries in the house. And I filled it out and made my mom sign it so that I could eat, you know, in high school, because otherwise I didn't eat. And, you know, for sixth grade, and I was an only child. And so I think it's expected that you grow up faster because you grow up around adults. And I remember sixth grade, for an entire year, I ate 3 Reese's peanut butter cups for lunch every day.
I get that.
Because the school lunch sucked and nobody told me, oh, you know, let me pack you a lunch, or, oh, you should pack a lunch. It was like, I go to school, I have 50 cents. That's my lunch. And it was just, nobody thought anything of it. I mean, my freshman year of high school, I failed 5 of 6 classes. And the reason why was because I wanted to see if anybody noticed. Wow. And nobody did. And I worked my butt off to graduate high school. You know, even to the point that I had to take so many classes to make up in sophomore and junior year that my senior year, I had 6 electives and 1 required class because I didn't take any electives because I had to catch up. And, you know, going back to that problem solving, and I think I told Jamie this story, when I was in junior high, I was in remedial math. Math was always my weakness. I'm really good at accounting, but I can't do math. And so in math class at the end, towards the end of the year, you had to take an exam to figure out what class you were going to be in high school, what math class. Well, I figured out really early on that on a Scantron test, if you could figure out the last 2 numbers of an answer, you had the answer. So I like just totally, I mean, I didn't ace it, but I got a really, really high score. And so I went from remedial math straight to algebra. And then proceeded to fail algebra first semester, put me in pre-algebra second semester, and then didn't get a math class in September or in the next June, in my sophomore year, because during that summer, my mother had decided, hey, let's move out of state to a little teeny tiny town in the middle of nowhere. And we stayed there for a few months and I started school there, and then it snowed and she went, oh no, I don't want to live here. And we came back. And when I came back, they're like, oh, well, we don't have a math class that matches up with what you're taking, so we just won't give you one. So by the time I got to my junior year, I had no math credit and ended up having to take it in summer school and in high school. And when I went into college classes, the only way I could pass math is if I took it in summer school, because I could remember the concepts for 6 weeks, but I couldn't remember them for an entire year or an entire semester. So it's just finding those little tricks and ways to be able to do things in order to get the job done that most people wouldn't look at.
And yeah, letting down that mask is nearly impossible at this point. And it's not impossible. It's not impossible, but like, it feels like it. It feels like it at times when you're raised like that. I moved 9 times in 11 years when I was a kid. And it's not like, oh, you move down the hall. It's like you moved schools. The longest I was ever in one place was high school, because I went to the same high school for all 4 years. And that was the longest I was ever in one place. And it is damaging. Don't believe anyone who tells you it's not. It's damaging to move that much. And then you learn the tricks that you're praised for.
Mm-hmm.
And when the tricks are solving the problems, when the tricks are making people laugh, when you can't let those guard, like as an adult, you're like, no, that's what I'm good at.
Mm-hmm.
I can't.
Well, that's what I'm known for. Like, that's just who I am. And that's kind of what led to the coaching, is because I realized that I've spent so much time coaching my friends and, you know, and even just colleagues through challenging issues. And then when I started getting coaching, I'm like, oh, that's what I'm doing. And then actually when I talked to my psychiatrist, my last appointment, and was talking to him about some of these things. And he's like, well, you know, I know you say you're doing coaching, but you're actually also providing therapy in a way to some of these people by telling them, you know, different ways to look at these issues. And that's just, well, that's just how my brain works.
Same. April and I aren't very different.
No, I was just going to say, it's really interesting to see the commonalities and how you guys grew up, and then also your coaching styles, and you're both incredibly effective coaches. And I know that firsthand because April coached me through my TEDx talk. And everyone knows that Maggie's my business coach. So that's really interesting. Do you guys think that there is a link between people who grew up having to be the solution finder and then later on working in the helping professions or becoming a coach? Do you think that there is a correlation there?
I do. I mean, I've always been interested in helping kids in foster care, just because I know how important it is to have that steady sense of family and somebody looking out for you. And I think about, especially kids who are in foster care who are older, and I did a lot in the foster care arena, especially when I was in politics, but even before that. And when a child who is in foster care gets to about the age of 16 or 17, the chances of them getting adopted just drops drastically, because when they're 18, they can be on their own. But what happens is, especially if they've moved around a lot and they haven't had a relationship with their natural parents, they may not have, say, for example, their birth certificate. No one has bothered to get them a driver's license. No one has taught them about how to, you know, plan for first and last month's rent when you want to get an apartment, and that you have to make deposits on utilities. Like, nobody teaches them that, because they don't have that family, that parental role model in their lives. And, you know, I got my first job at 15. And again, it was one of those things that I fell into. I wrote an essay to apply for a job that was at a baseball park, and then was told I couldn't have the job because I was a girl and only boys technically qualified. And then they called me and said, oh, would you be willing to, you know, be a ball girl and sit on the field and help out? And then from then I ended up staying 3 summers just as an usherette and selling programs and selling season tickets and working in the, I did every job that they had, but it was all because I broke my glasses at the age of 8. My mother refused to replace them. And when I was 16 and I was driving, I went to the eye doctor and then got contact lenses for the first time in my life, and realized that those things in the distance were leaves on trees.
Wow.
Because I couldn't see, I didn't have any distance vision, and I couldn't see well enough, but I wasn't able to do that until I got a job. So it's like, I had to find the answer to getting what I needed by getting a job. I had to find the answer to getting through high school by, you know, figuring out the classes that I could pass and how to pass them. You know, all of these things, because it's that whole growing up, oh, if you would just apply yourself, you know, we have report cards up the yin yang that just say, oh, if you would just apply yourself, you know, oh, you know, we tested her for, you know, for the academically talented program, but, you know, she could section, so we couldn't give it. It's like, but I could read at a fifth grade level by first grade. Like, you know, I can find answers, you know, quickly. I ran out of stuff to do by the end, by the middle of first grade. And they're like, you want to go to second grade? You know, so it's just that whole being able to go, all right, well, this doesn't work. What else can I do? Instead of like, oh, well, that doesn't work. I guess I can't do anything. You know, it's what else can we do that's going to be able to solve this problem or get us to where we need to be? And for me, one of the big things is recognizing that as a neurodivergent person, social constructs don't work for me. And as I've gotten older, I've been a lot braver about going, well, you know what? Then I'm not going to follow that social construct. I'm going to do it the way I want to do it that works best for me.
So you are, it sounds like, engaging in that process of at least taking down the mask a little bit, because not engaging in those social constructs and the way the society tells you to requires you to not act right in line as like a neurotypical. So do you feel that way, that you're starting to take down that mask in different aspects of your life?
A little bit. I think for me, one of the things that really brought the mask to life, other than the question from my first coach, was when, after I was diagnosed and I tried to go into therapy, and I'm still trying, but I found a therapist and she asked me about my life and told her, obviously to a little bit more detail than what I've said here, and quickly realized based on her response that I was suddenly put on a pedestal. Like, she was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you've gotten where you've gotten with everything that you've been through. And, you know, again,
yes,
that was just my life. I didn't think it was anything. I didn't think it was a big deal. And, you know, the whole, you know, I can't believe you've done this and look where you are. And all of a sudden I'm on pedestal. I'm like, well, now I can't be vulnerable with you because I can't ruin the person that I've created in your mind. So this relationship is not going to work.
Correct. I have been there. People, high achieving appearing. I don't know English. We have a problem finding therapists that will work with us on that deeper level, without being, oh God, it sounds so dickish to say impressed, but who don't give a shit what we've done, mm-hmm. who genuinely don't care and are just like, yeah, I'm not impressed by you. It's like when we work with high performing clients and we have to be like, your problems are still the same as everyone else's. It doesn't matter what you've done. You still have, like, we all have the same root issues. Some mm-hmm. people have worked through them. Some people haven't. Some people have them appearing in different ways. Some are deeper than others, but there are only so many different issues, right? Like abandonment, so on. Like, there are only so many issues. So finding, like, you and I and people who behave like us, we have to find people who don't give a shit about what we've accomplished. Like, they mm-hmm. just don't care. And they don't care about our past. And they're not like, oh my gosh, how did you work through that? You tell me, you're the therapist. Like, like, that's the problem, is when people start to act like, oh, like, don't look at me with pity. I mm-hmm. swear I will slap you. I will Will Smith your ass. Like, do not look at me with pity, or we're going to have a problem.
No, I totally agree. It's, you know, and I think, again, the advantage of, you know, being neurodiverse, like, there's not a lot of people that I'm like in awe of. Like, I don't, there aren't, I mean, I've met a lot of really important people. And I think really the only couple of people that I were just awestruck, obviously I met each of the Obamas. I met Barack and Michelle. And I was
I know this. How did this not come up during our 6 hour Zoom conversations? Sorry, continue.
Sorry. But like I was awestruck. But the thing that was really funny is when I met the president and I was like, this was really cool. I was actually more excited about meeting his press secretary at the time because I just thought he was like the coolest person because he had like no shame. Like he would just say what he wanted to say very respectfully, but he would say it. And so when I ran it, like he's the person I got an autograph from. I have a picture with the president, but I got an autograph from his press secretary because I was just like, he's so cool, you know? So it's just, but like I've met, you know, especially here in Nevada, there's a lot of really important wealthy people and I've met them and I've been respectful to them, but I'm not just like, oh, I can't, you know, I can't say anything wrong. I can't do anything wrong. I had a job once that one of the owners of the company was well known for he was scary. Like everybody in the office was scared of him. And he had known my father for years. And that's kind of how I had gotten that job. And I would always like make cracks when he was in the room and people are like, you can't do that. And I'm like, no, really, the man does have a sense of humor. You just kind of have to get past it. So it's just that not being intimidated by other people, but being intimidated in other situations. My biggest like weakness, I will try and crawl into a corner. If you put me in a large room filled with women, if you put me in a room with, you know, men and women, I'm generally fine. If you put me on a stage, I'm great. Like I can do my thing. But if you put me in a group of women, I am just completely intimidated and terrified because I just instantly feel like I don't fit in. I'm judged. I can't be too smart. I can't talk too much, you know? So it's that understanding where I can and can't be me. And how to kind of mask it so that it works in the situation.
So I have a question because you guys are both talking about you were raised in this way. So being the solution finder is almost like internalized part of your personality, part of who you are, part of your identity. But we're also talking about how that is a mask and masks are exhausting and feels like a weight on your shoulders. And obviously you're both amazing people, not to like put you both on a pedestal, but you are both amazing people and I love your personalities. And I would never tell either of you to change. How do you separate when it's you versus like you and your personality versus when it's a mask? Because obviously one is, you know, more favorable than the other. How do you differentiate the two?
I don't think I can. I think that's kind of where that whole dropping the mask altogether is terrifying and way too vulnerable. I think the mask gets thicker in certain situations. You know, when I'm in a new situation and I have to try and fit in or sit back and wait and not. And I think my mask up until this point was built on a title. I always wanted a better job, not because I wanted more money, but because I wanted a better title, because then that would earn me respect in, you know, in my brain. Like that's what made me important. And my entire career was all about getting a better and better title. And now as a consultant, like, and as someone who's just gotten older, I'm just like, fuck it. I don't care. Like, you know, I don't need it to feel valuable and valued. And it's been a big adjustment for me But I, you know, look back over my life, and when I was younger, I job hopped every year because I just wanted a better title. I learned what I needed to learn. I can do this job. Now I got to go do something else. And just kind of, because I wanted to get somewhere. And then when I got there, I went, oh, this sucks. I'm not doing this, and completely changed direction. So it's just, you know, and then there's times where, like I said earlier, like I got a job I was completely unqualified for, but I figured it out. And then I figured out, yeah, I can do this. Don't particularly like it very much, but I can do it. And now I want to go do something else.
So I was going to ask you, Maggie, specifically on this one, and April, if you've had clients in this realm as well, when you're coaching a client who has been through those similar childhood experiences and has this mask, how does one go about that? I'm just very curious.
Go about what?
Are people who carry around this mask, are there like certain barriers you have to break through in order for them to experience a breakthrough? Is it very different from coaching somebody who is going to ask a lot of questions? I'm just curious.
So I'm actually in the process of bringing down my mask. You should, Jamie, you may have noticed, because when you ask questions I don't know the answers to, rather than being like, oh, here's a made up answer that I pulled from Google and I hope it's right, which is what I used to do. Now I will either give you a book recommendation where I think I remember seeing something on it, or I'll be like, I don't know, but so-and-so is an expert in this.
Yeah.
And it used to be like, I would go look at so-and-so's stuff and give you an answer based on their research. Now I'm just like, go check out so-and-so. I don't, that's their stuff. That's not my stuff. I don't do that. So when you see a client though, that's stuck in this, it's first the most important to validate the experience because they likely don't know that they're there. And that's the hardest part, is the fact that they won't be aware of it. I mean, April herself says that her first coach is the one who brought it to her attention, and she's still working. How long ago was your first coach, April?
Like 2 years.
Yeah. It takes a long time.
Yeah.
So
well, I'm getting better at asking questions and oh, I don't understand that. It's still hard, and there's certain situations. There's certain environments I won't do that in, because I know if I listen long enough, 9 times out of 10, I can figure it out. Mm-hmm. So I am getting better at that. But I think for me, my answer is a little different than Maggie's, because I also believe that part of that mask really is part of your authentic self now. Like you've had it for so long, if this is an adult, or especially someone my age, like it's just part of you. And so recognizing it, and if you're okay with it, then making that part of your authentic self, because that's kind of what my coaching is based on, is being authentic to who you are and not constantly trying to fit into a social construct that doesn't work for you. So if the smartest person in the room is what works for you, then let's make that authentically you and learn how to do it so that it's becomes part of who you are and it fits your values. If it doesn't fit your values, then let's talk about different ways to look at it.
And also the last thing any coach should be doing ever, and I'm going to should all over these people, is fostering dependence. Mm-hmm. And if you take away somebody's ability to problem solve, you just foster dependence and you're an asshole.
Yeah. And that's, for me, that's been the hardest thing that I have. That's the thing that I work the most on as a coach, is not giving you the answer, but giving you the tools to figure out the answer. You know, it's like,
yeah,
if it's a matter of time blindness, here's some ways that you might look at that. Have you thought about timing yourself when you're doing a certain task and seeing how long it actually takes you? And then I may give an example for my own life. I thought that something took me this amount of time and I timed it and it's like, oh, it actually only took me 2 minutes, but I thought that it took me, you know, 10 minutes. So using those examples and giving them the tools so that they can do it themselves, but not saying, well, let's sit down and do this together. It's like, no, you do it and you need to give me permission to hold you accountable. Or if you choose not to, that's fine. But just know that you have to do this yourself. I can't do it for you.
Exactly. You can't outsource your pushups, right? I mean, like, how many times have we heard that?
Yeah. You can't. I mean, because one of my favorite sayings is, if everyone would just do what I tell them to do, everything would be fine. Like,
oh, just bingo.
Follow what I say and it will all work out. But I've learned that I have to let people figure that out for themselves. And just making sure that depending on the situation, you know, they either own the solution themselves, or they find the solution that works best for them. And I've had to learn to not be offended when someone doesn't take my advice. If somebody comes to me for, you know, for help with a problem and I say, oh, well, you could do X, Y, and Z. And then they go, no, I'm going to do something completely different. I used to get really upset. Like, you came to me and I gave you an answer. Why wouldn't you follow it? And I've gotten to the point where I'm just like, this is an option. And I let it go. And if they choose not to do it, then that's their choice. And, you know, peace out. Uh-huh.
Maggie's laughing. And I know we've talked about this before about, now, correct me if I'm wrong, but you've had frustrations in the past, Maggie, when you would give advice or when you've been asked advice and then they don't take it. So that goes right in line with does it feel like a personal dig when somebody doesn't take your advice? Is that why it's frustrating? Like,
I think it depends who it is.
Okay.
If it's a client, it's like, well, you're paying me. I don't know. Whatever. Mm-hmm. But when it's like somebody you know and you trust personally and they don't take your advice after asking for it, you're like, okay, so I trust you. You don't trust me. That's cool. That's good. That's awesome. Mm-hmm. I'm so glad you asked for my advice and you don't trust me enough to implement it. That's cool. I like that. Makes me feel good about myself. But I trust you. You don't trust me. Got it. Super cool. Don't ask me for advice ever again. I swear. It's not a big deal. I'm not bitter. But like with clients, if they ask for my advice and they don't implement it, I'm like, whatever, dude, you'll be back and you will keep pushing along, making something that doesn't work keep going. And then eventually you'll be like, so I tried it the way you said and it worked out. Or, well, they won't, and it won't work. And that's fine too.
Well, I know for me, and Maggie may have this experience, that frustration of giving advice and it not being followed, I think also comes from parenting, because when you have, especially a teenager, you are the biggest idiot to walk the face of the earth, but anyone else who tells them the exact same advice is brilliant.
They're just brilliant. And I just, like, my spouse listens to me, but I don't listen to my spouse. So I actually do it to Sean. Like, I'll hear what he says. He says great things. And I go, that's really smart, but I don't implement it until I hear it from somebody else. And then all of a sudden I'll do it. And he'll be like, I have been screaming that. I swear. I have been saying that's a good idea. I don't understand why someone else had to say it. I'm like, I don't understand either. Anyway. And then like, I just go about my life. Like, I didn't just insult my partner of like 20 something years, 21. I guess we've been together 23, but whatever. And I'm just like, ha, 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 ha.
But I think that also comes from with the ADHD. If somebody tells you to do something, you're much less likely to do it or to do it that way. There's just this instant, like, no. And I've also been conscious about learning why I say no. It's not just the whole, you know, neurodivergent no. There's actually, if I look deep enough, a reason behind it. As an empath, I know that I can get emotionally involved very easily. And so, you know, the perfect example in my household is movies or television shows. Like my, you know, my husband will say, oh, you should watch. There's a show that he wants me to watch. He's been bugging me to watch. And I'm like, no, I don't want to watch it. He's like, but it's a great show. And I'm like, I don't want to watch it. And he's like, I don't understand. I'm like, and I've told him some of this, but I haven't told him all of it because I figured it out recently. It's Breaking Bad. So we watched Better Call Saul and I enjoyed it until like the last few seasons. And we used to binge watch, like we'd watch two shows and then we would stop. And as Maggie knows, then we would watch two episodes of Seinfeld because I needed that comic relief. But there were times where it got really emotional for me. And I'm like, I can't watch another one right now. Like I need a break. Breaking Bad. Like I grew up with, you know, I had a half sister that was a drug addict that lived with us for a while. I grew up watching drug abuse in my house. I grew up watching people with addiction issues in my home. I don't want to watch it on television for fun. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, that's why I would never watch like that show Intervention. Like I grew up with, I don't want to watch that. I want to watch something that's fun. That's going to make me laugh and I will watch the same, you know, five comedies over and over and over again and recite them as the movie goes on, which fortunately my husband puts up with, but most people wouldn't. And my whole world is based on movie quotes. Like I use movie quotes or television quotes randomly in conversation because those things are comfortable and those things are safe and they bring me joy versus bringing me that emotional challenge that certain things that reflect my past bring up.
I am exactly the same. I will not watch anything that upsets me or could upset me. After Guardians 2, I will not watch the Guardians of the Galaxy movies because Guardians 2 made me cry so hard and I wasn't prepared for it because there's a major death in it and I wasn't prepared. And I've been experiencing major death in my life since my best friend died when I was 5 and in a horrible car crash and like decapitated horrible car crash. And I won't watch things like that now. So, And I will watch so much. And Sean is very similar as well. My husband, he's very similar. He won't watch, like I wanted to watch, I love true crime and I wanted to watch the Jared Subway story on how they caught him because he's, you know, a scumbag and the worst. And I wanted to find out how they found out he was a scumbag, like what led to it. And Sean has a past of abuse. So he's like, no, thank you. I don't need to know this shit. So when he went to bed last night, I was like, I'm going to settle in and find out how they caught this pederast sex pest. I hate him. Let's find out. And it turns out to be horrible. And I do not recommend watching that. It's really upsetting. Don't watch it. I shouldn't have watched it, but I watched it all the way through anyway. But like, you have to make sure you watch it without the people who have been affected. But meanwhile, I was like, I have to watch it all the way through because there's something wrong with my brain. I love it though. I'm like, I'm demented.
You told me that there were studies that showed, oh, sorry, go ahead, April.
I was just going to say just another relation to that was I worked in television news on 9/11. And so I was getting ready for work. We had a TV in the bathroom and I watched the second plane hit and I immediately just threw clothes on and went straight to work because I knew we would be busy. I worked in a newsroom and, you know, we had TVs on and we were listening to it all day long and, you know, pulling copy. And I got so emotional in it that when we went to the museum where the Trade Center towers were, where the towers were, we walked into a room that had all the TVs going in, and I walked out. I'm like, I can't do it. Like, it just brings back so many memories of that day. And, you know, and I don't have the trauma that the people that lived in New York and or lost people. And I don't pretend to compare that at all, but it was just the emotional, just the overwhelming, overstimulating feeling of just living in that, you know, working for, I think I was there for like 15 hours that day. And all I did was make sure that everybody else had what they needed, that they got fed, that, you know, people got breaks when they needed breaks. Like, that was all I did, but it was just that constant stimulation of that noise that I can't handle it.
I was pregnant.
Oh.
I was pregnant on 9/11 with the kid who just turned 21 to die yesterday. And yeah, it was nobody. I don't want to talk about that. That's not something I like talking about.
Jamie, did you have a question? Sorry, I interrupted you.
That's okay. It wasn't important. I was going to say, Maggie, you're talking about how there's something wrong with you because you like watching shows that are like terrifying. Didn't you say that there's a study that like people who have gone through abuse in childhood?
It makes us feel safe. Because we feel safe in an uncertain situation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very, so that's why I like to watch 2020 and Dateline nonstop, and also Investigation Discovery.
Yeah.
But I only have Discovery Plus because of MILF Manor, which is the worst show I've ever seen.
Is it? I really want to watch it.
It's absolutely terrible.
But do you like reality TV? Because I love reality TV. Okay.
Yeah. And Sean, the whole reason we watch it is because Sean wanted to watch it. So we watched it, and I hate watch it. I literally hate watch it. Sean puts it on every week, and every week I'm like, God, I hate the show. I hate the show so much. I hate everything about the show. And then I sit there like this and watch it. And it's disgusting.
That's hilarious.
That's the whole reason we have Discovery Plus.
That's hilarious. That's it.
But so Discovery Plus is on there.
Discovery Plus is the only place. Oh, okay. So get that instead, or watch.
No,
that
it's
instead.
On there. It's on there.
Oh, okay.
True crime.
Okay. April, I really appreciate you coming on and being vulnerable and sharing your experiences. I mean, we're talking about the mask of perfectionism and how hard it is bringing that mask down, and to share that with our audience, like, is just. We really, really, really appreciate you. And this is going to resonate with so many people. And thank you so much for sharing.
Well, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity. And thank you, Maggie, for inviting me. And, you know, I think that it's things that people need to talk about. You know, I think more people need to talk about, you know, we've talked more about mental illness as a society over the last few years. And I think now with ADHD and so many women, you know, the one of the largest generations right now is Generation X, and these women are coming into menopause, and without those hormones, it just kind of unmasks, no pun intended, the symptoms of ADHD that many women didn't realize that they were able to function with because of the hormones. And then once those hormones start to dissipate, all of a sudden these things that, you know, they thought weren't really there, weren't a problem, become a problem. And for me, my whole diagnosis was based on the fact that I had an extremely stressful job for 7 years. And when I left my job, I thought, oh, well, there's these little things that were happening to me, like those will get better because I don't have stress. And when I realized that the same things were happening without the stress, then I started looking, going, okay, what else could cause these things to happen? And started doing research, and then looked into ADHD, and was very fortunate to be able to find a psychiatrist and get an appointment pretty quickly, and went in and said, I don't know if this is what it is, but this is what I suspect. And because I have you know, because I suspect my mother had bipolar, I had to kind of be, he had to decide like, okay, is it one end of the spectrum or the other? So I was very fortunate in my diagnosis, and it's still difficult to talk about to a lot of people. I've had somebody tell me somebody I trusted and I told them, and their reaction to me was, but you're so smart. And I'm just like, most people who are neurodivergent are highly intelligent. That's how we function in society. Mm-hmm. So it's still not comfortable to talk about that to a lot of people. I don't really have a relationship with my father and my stepmother right now anyways, but I haven't told them, and I have no intention of telling them, because they wouldn't believe me anyways.
Oh, a lot of things I could say about that, but I'll keep my mouth shut. So let's just say that Lizzie listener is listening to this podcast and they're like, I really want to get a hold of April and I don't know where to find her. Where would we send Lizzie listener to?
My website is called synergynpc.com. Synergy Nonprofit Consulting. Or you can find me on LinkedIn, and that's where I do most of my posting for my business. And you know, there's a blog on my website that has a lot of good information too, especially about nonprofit and just kind of, like I said, just getting started in the coaching business. So there's coaching information. If people are interested in being coached through a crossroads, the name of the coaching program is called Navigating Forks. And it's kind of a tongue in cheek about dealing with a fork in the road.
I love it. Thank you so much again, April. We appreciate you.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Bye.
Bye, guys. Bye.